Hello and welcome to the latest edition of Seattle Nice, the only podcast that reveals what's really happening in Seattle politics on the surface and behind the scenes. I'm David Hyde with Erica C. Barnett of Publicola. Hi, Erica.
Hey, David. Big promises.
We're Seattle's only podcast.
That's political consultant Sandeep Kaushik. On today's show, Seattle Mayor Bruce Harrell's out with his proposed new budget. But just for folks who don't follow this stuff as carefully as Erica and Sandeep do, remember, the city council's the institution that controls the purse strings. They're really the budget deciders. And this being an election year, this story, I think, has a lot to do. I'm going to ask Erica about this in a minute, but with the mayor's fight for reelection. And I think some of these headlines reflect that. Cairo went with a sort of Republican-ish headline. Seattle faces higher taxes under Harrell's proposed budget. Como had Seattle mayor rolls out budget with big spending. KOW, I don't think, covered it, presumably because some reporters are irreplaceable. In the Seattle Times, the Google News headline was studiously neutral. What's in Harrell's nearly $9 billion Seattle budget proposal? Although when you click the site, you get Harrell pitches boost to police spending in latest Seattle budget. From the progressive left, the urbanist, Harrell budget doubles down on police spending because they don't like that. The Stranger went with a kind of short paragraph and a link to the Seattle Times piece. And our own Erica C. Barnett of Publicola's got Harrell's latest budget spikes city's deficit by piling on new spending in election year. Erica, we should be concerned about future deficits, it sounds like, in this new budget.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the emphasis that we saw on the police spending is, you know, is well-placed. I mean, it's absolutely true that the budget that Harrell has proposed includes a lot of money for new police. It's arguable whether that needs to come out of new funding, since the budget also, I believe, is the first time that public safety, most overwhelmingly police spending, makes up more than half of the general fund. But I think big picture, this budget is very much an election year budget. There is a lot of new spending at a time when we are facing a deficit of at least $150 million, according to the latest revenue forecasts. And this budget essentially pushes that problem off until 2027 and beyond. And it does that, you know, by both adding a bunch of new taxes, as our Republicanish colleagues, I think, as you put it, said. So there's the previously announced sales tax increase that the city council is going to have to pass by mid-October to pay for a bunch of new non-police public safety stuff and to backfill the deficit. And then there's also the business and occupation tax increase that the city proposed earlier this year. So there are new taxes, but there's also a lot of one-time spending on stuff that is probably going to be ongoing needs, like immigration supports, like food assistance for people who are going to be cut off of benefits from the federal government. And Harrell doesn't really propose a way to pay for those long-term. He makes them all one time and essentially pushes off the budget problems until possibly a new mayor, Katie Wilson, is in office. One other thing that it does is it creates massive deficits starting in 2027, which is the next budget year. So it essentially does balance the budget as they have to do by law every year. But immediately the budget gets into deficits that push it to the hundreds of millions of dollars in the next couple of years.
Sandeep, do you share Erica's concerns about this real budget deficit?
Well, there are issues here. You know, there's a bunch of new spending. There's some, even though there's new taxes, I think Erica's right that there's some bow wave stuff where it's creating, you know, commitments or future spending that they don't know where that's going to come from right now. And so that there are, you know, out year projected deficits and stuff. But my concerns or my questions about this budget were, I think, a little bit different from Erica. So first of all, I totally agree. This is an election year budget. Even the way this budget got rolled out, right? It wasn't the traditional in-person budget speech in front of the council in chambers or at some location. It was done for this fairly slick produced 15-minute video that got released to the Seattle Channel. And that very much, I think, reads as much a sort of, you know, campaign document as it does a budget speech. You know, there's sort of shots of Bruce Harrell delivering his speech in various sort of scenic locations. He starts at the overlook of the, you know, the new waterfront, right? And it's sort of a celebration of things that have been accomplished, you know, as he sort of makes this argument that the city's, in good shape, but there still needs to be work in certain areas and we have to do it. And by the way, I'm fighting Trump the whole way, right? That the ongoing theme of this is that Trump says, he uses the word crap hole. Trump calls Seattle a crap hole. But, you know, really look around. Look how great this city is. And I'm making it better and I'm fighting for it. So obviously that's very campaigny, right?
I think campaigning to the point of being questionable. Since city resources were used to produce it.
Right. I am curious how much got spent on making this video.
Read public cola, read your future public cola story to find the answer.
Okay. All right, I will. But this, Trishan, look, they used to always do the budget speech as a speech by the mayor in chambers to the council, right? That's the way it was traditionally done. Jenny Durkin was the first one to do a kind of video budget speech. She did a very short, but that was in the sort of COVID era, and maybe there was
It was her last year, too, and she knew she wasn't coming back. She didn't run. So it was like a six-minute speech, very perfunctory. Kind of laughable. This is different.
She's like, I don't want to talk to reporters anyway.
Yeah, but in the middle of that the sort of COVID era or whatever. So maybe, you know, whatever. But so I thought it was a little odd that this wasn't, you know, kind of, you know, that it was done this way, right? And I am curious to see how much got spent on it. It is a pretty elaborate production. But my concern about it is I really think my top line thing is that it's even as a campaign speech, I kind of think this is a little bit of a missed opportunity for the mayor. Even though there's these new taxes, even though he's announcing new spending in these various areas, we're going to 70% increase to immigrant and refugee stuff. And we're going to, you know, there's more police spending, but that is, by the way, primarily to pay for all the new cops they're hiring, which, as you call in previous budget cycles, remember when we had a big debate about cutting the 80 unfilled cop positions because progressives are saying, hey, they're not going to get filled. So let's cut that money and use it for other stuff. Remember, we had a big fight about that. Well, turns out they started filling those positions and now they
yet they're not using that money. Strangely enough, they're asking for new money. They're asking for $26 million in new funding to pay for a net total of 76 officers. So they actually, in fact, Sandeep, are not using the money that was sitting unused in the budget. So it almost sounds like progressives would have been right to reuse that money since they're just going to ask for more money on top of their massive budget anyway.
Coming back to look, if you want to look at this as a political document, as a campaign speech, what I mean by a missed opportunity is this new spending, it still feels incremental, right? It all feels like additions on to stuff that's already happening, you know? So it talks about, hey, we're spending $350 million on housing, the most ever, you know, but it's like a small increase in the recent housing
budget. It's a subinflationary $1 million.
Yeah, right, as you've talked about, right? So none of that, and what I don't see here, what is the big, bold, new initiative? What is the big change, the kind of grab for the brass rings, the thing that's really going to grab people's attention? And so in a weird way, this budget felt both like a bunch of new spending, but also kind of status quo.
I mean, I would say an honest budget would have cut. I think an honest budget that was planning for the future of Seattle and not just the future of the mayor's political career would have included significant cuts, particularly in areas where we're spending a fuck ton of money. The city this year, of course, added a bunch of money for new CCTV camera surveillance. The budget adds a ton of money for things like graffiti cleanup that the mayor is obsessed with, as we discussed. But it also, I mean, going back to that one-time spending, and you were mentioning spending on immigration, trying to combat the Trump administration on immigration, all that stuff is one time. So those out-year bow wave problems where, you know, you see the mayor's budget going into deficits of, you know, negative $78 million next year, negative $269 million in 2028, $375 million in 2029. That all would be worse if he hadn't made a bunch of this stuff that is definitely going to be ongoing needs one time. And so if Katie Wilson is the next mayor or if Bruce Harrell is the next mayor, they will have to deal with, you know, these multi-hundred million dollar built-in deficits that the mayor has put in his budget. Plus, if they want to fund any of that stuff, like food assistance, you know, making up for SNAP benefit cuts, and things like immigration assistance, legal aid, all kinds of stuff that is going to be ongoing, it's going to make those problems even worse because those are all counted as one time. So I would say, I mean, this is not an election year, comment that I'm making, but a responsible budget and actually bold statement would have been to acknowledge the financial realities that the city is in and, you know, and try to make some cuts, you know, or at least not pile on $50 million in new programs. Last year, Harold piled on $100 million in new programs, or I should say Harold and the council ultimately. This year, it's another $50 million. And yeah, some of that's coming from new taxes, but this is just the opposite of a budget that makes any kind of tough choices. And Harold has been talking on the campaign trail constantly about how his job is to make tough choices.
So, Erica, would you support new spending? Obviously, you don't like the spending, but would you support new spending if there were new taxes
to pay
for it? I like some
of the spending. I just spent a lot of things. I just.
No. I mean, you don't love, you know, doubling down on police spending or whatever. But would you support new taxes to pay for these things, or just as a matter of principle, you'd rather see budget cutting, like when the Wilson administration takes over?
Well, obviously, it's not a simple question.
Okay, explain it to me.
I mean, as I said, would I like new taxes? We're going to have new taxes. I think we need progressive taxes for other things. And I think this sets up Katie Wilson, if she becomes mayor, to have a really tough time passing additional taxes because, you know, as we've mentioned, I mean, Harold put two new taxes in this budget. So this budget depends on the passage of two new taxes. So I don't know that it's, I mean, would I like taxes or cuts? I mean,
in other words, if he managed to balance the budget as opposed to threaten us with future deficits, are you saying you'd be more supportive of that despite some of your qualms about the spending, where the money's being spent?
I think mayors should try to balance the budget or at least, you know, reduce the amount of deficits they're assuming in future years, as they historically have tried to do. Now, during COVID, that, you know, was definitely less the case. But I mean, you know, I mean, Harold is, for one thing, relying on the Jumpstart payroll tax, which was supposed to pay originally for housing and other needs to balance this budget. So it's not just these new taxes. But yeah, I mean, I think if your budget is, you know, wowie gee, we have a $0, you know, let me say that again. I think if your budget is, you know, balanced and you take credit for the fact that it's balanced, which it has to be, it should be closer to balanced next year. Like if your plan is, you know, I'm going to spend less this year, or I'm going to, you know, push everything off until next year, you're still going to have to deal with next year. It doesn't go away. And so, yeah, I mean, I'm not a budget writer, but I think that, you know, for example, the $26 million for new police officers could have been found within the existing massive police budget, or at least some of it. I would start by not doing CCTV camera surveillance, and go from there. The SPD's budget is extraordinarily opaque. And so it's very hard to know exactly what is in that, approximately, $500 million budget. But yeah, I mean, that's where I'd probably start looking for sure. And I don't think Harold, made any of those tough choices. I think he just said everybody can have everything. And it's somebody else's problem.
Isn't that the progressive thing to do in Seattle? Look,
this is the thing that Harold did during his last budget.
I will say this. I think if Harold had come forward with what you wanted and really scrubbed the budget and said, I'm going to be cutting these programs and goring some oxes of like this organization is not going to get money because we're not seeing results from it or whatever, I think there would be a hue and cry coming from the progressive side saying this is austerity budgets, right? This is the cry we've heard from the previous council.
You're pretending it's neutral to say we're only going to cut social services. That's not a neutral decision. I mean, when people say austerity budgets, it's because the budget...
If he scrubbed the police budget.
It's because the budget cuts things that help the most vulnerable and poorest people. That it's not just that it's a lower budget or that it's less spending. I mean, there's no such thing as neutral spending choices.
Hey, Seattle Nice listeners. Seattle politics got you low. Well, get high with Uncle Ike's. Pissed at the mayor? Relax with a dollar joint. Pop a tire in a pothole? Eat a $2 gummy and chill. Whether you need something to pump you up for Saturday's protest or a mellow strain for your next sit-in, Ike's is your best friend. Now is the time to roll up, Seattle. Download the Ike's app today or head on over to Ike's.com. That's Ike's.com.
I mean, basically, you just want to cut the police budget. That's what you're really arguing, I think, and our myth that he's increasing it. I mean,
I'm not even arguing for cutting it. I'm saying that, you know, we were told over and over again that they have to keep, as you said, Sandeep, that we have to keep all these positions vacant so that and funded so that when police come back, we will be able to fund them out of those positions and out of that money. The second we started getting a, you know, dramatic net increase in new police officers, that money suddenly is no longer available. It disappears. It's vanished. And we have to add $26 million to the budget just for those positions. I think as a budget hawk, Sandeep, you should be, looking at that and saying, huh, why is that?
I'm very much in agreement that, like, I don't think anybody's fucking scrubbed the Seattle City budget in more than a decade, right? Like, so I think there are, like, you know, all sorts of different places where you could go in and say, like, let's do some performance auditing of what are we getting out of this program, whether it's social services or police stuff or anywhere in the budget, you know, Office of Sustainability, there's a big increase for that in this budget too. And like, you know, have we been looking at like everything they're doing to see like, what are we getting results here? I mean, even the immigrant and refugees increase, right? The 70% increase. When I look at the like, legal aid, right? This thing of okay, Trump's going to come after undocumented people and, you know, we need to provide legal aid to them. That's $300,000. I mean, it's something, but it's not like some massive amount of money. So all that, even the increase in that area, in that office, is largely incremental increases to kind of stuff they're already doing that has nothing to do with Trump, right? You know, and so, yeah, I do think that there are places, you know, I mean, your critique is, like I said, you're kind of taking my critique in this weird way and turning it into an attack on Harold. I do think there are plenty of places where that Seattle budget, the Office of Housing, we've talked about that before, and that $600 million sitting in the Office of Housing. And like, what, are we looking at that? And oh, no, we can't talk about that because some of that money is EDI, you know, the equity. And
that's not actually why. I mean, it's again, it's, you know, you and Sarah Nelson keep pushing this erroneous claim that we can spend money that has been dedicated. Now, the Office of Housing has had approximately the same amount of money in its, in its budget for housing construction for capital funding for year after year after year after year. I mean, it has not grown substantially. It fluctuates based on the actual.
Oh, it's grown some. It was like three.
Not very much, and not okay. Without going down the rabbit hole of like $10 million here or there out of hundreds of millions, you can't just spend that money. I mean, it is, you know, the city of Seattle is the first funder on projects, and when you're the first funder, you do have to wait for the rest of the funding to come in. I mean, there are logical reasons. This has been explained many times. You can't just raid the Office of Housing budget. That would be incredibly irresponsible. And so, you know, I don't think that's where
there are projects that the Office of Housing funded 5+ years ago that have not moved forward. And nobody is taking a look at, like, why have those projects not moved forward in more than half a decade?
I disagree that nobody's taken a look. And I mean, they've discussed this ad infinitum at the city council. But regardless, I mean, I guess the problem is, I mean, the big picture problem is that, you know, this budget is very transparently, I think, an election year budget. And I think when you budget that way, you know, you're not thinking of the city, you're thinking of yourself. You know, I mean, and not to overstate that, but I mean, there's just this budget doesn't plan for the future. It acts as if Seattle doesn't have a future beyond 2026 that it needs to worry about. And we very much do, because the Trump administration is here for 4 years, among many other reasons.
When it comes to the politics of this, Sandeep, Croman's first paragraph in the Seattle Times Mayor Bruce Harrell's proposed 2026 budget includes more than $40 million in additional spending for cops, blah, 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 as Harrell seeks to make good on his top campaign promise. I mean, from his point of view, that seems like a pretty positive first paragraph and headline in some ways. So what I didn't see in here, and I saw it in one comment, was what's this budget going to do in terms of streamlining housing construction? Is there new money for people to you know, make the permitting process happen more quickly, or those kinds of good governance things? I'm not seeing a ton of bold new ideas here that are either left, right, or center particularly. But from Harrell's perspective, this seems to reflect kind of what he ran on and what he's done. Public safety, go down the list.
I think that's right. Again, watch that 15-minute, budget speech video, and that's very much the theme of it, is he's all over the cities talking about, look, here's stuff we have funded over the last 4 years that has doing good things. Here's some, affordable housing we funded. Look at this great, waterfront that we've created. Look at this neighborhood, center that we renovated. And, so I do think he's making an argument, call it a city argument or a campaign argument, whatever you want to call it. But he's making an argument that, like, hey, we made a lot of progress over the last 4 years. Let me show you tangible stuff that we've done. And by the way, we're going to do more of this stuff, and I'm investing in more of it, and we're going to do more over here and more over here, build up to more housing and blah, 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 right? And that's fine so far as it goes, but what you're not hearing here is, A, what you're saying, where's the innovation, the reform, the change from what we're already doing, right? If people are frustrated with the status quo, what are you offering them that's different? And there's not much difference here. There's more, but not different, right? And I'm not sure that's the right pitch.
Okay, Sandeep, what I'm wondering is, how these candidates that are running against Bruce Harrell, I hear Erica's criticism. I haven't heard from any of the candidates. What's Katie Wilson saying? Is she going to go in there and cut the police budget if she's elected? So if this is an election year budget, I'll be curious to see what the response is. But Erica, I know you wanted to respond to Sandeep.
Well, the only thing I wanted to say about the examples that he gave, is, the waterfront is a great example of something that Bruce Harrell didn't do. That process began, way, way, way back in the Nichols administration and has continued apace through that whole time. It opened under Harrell, but I don't think that Harrell can rightly take credit for the downtown waterfront happening. And so I think that that is just an example of Harrell sort of saying, I did this. And that is also a tendency that I saw in the debate last night. We're recording this on Thursday. I watched a debate last night where Harrell, suggested that elected officials of today are the ones who can take credit for things that, often took a lot of people and a lot of efforts and a lot of advocacy to pass. And he was using that as a criticism of Katie Wilson. So that's all I wanted to respond to, that the idea that, look at the big things we've done. Well, Harrell didn't do that, but he was there to cut the ribbon.
I have not, David, to your question, I have not heard much response yet from Katie or, city council candidates to it. I did talk to one council member who shall go nameless in the last 24 hours who was a little flummoxed by this budget. I think to the point that Erica was making earlier, the out-year deficits has not been lost on some of the council members who are kind of looking at it going like, hey, I thought we had a big budget deficit coming into this year. So what is all this new spending and why are there like big deficits sort of going out forward? Is this really, anchored in good budgeting techniques or whatever was the question the council member was raising with me. But I actually think most likely the council will do what it always does, which it takes the mayor's budget and will kind of tweak around the edges, and this budget will substantially be the budget that the city ends up adopting.
With those deficits.
With those out-year deficits, yeah.
And I think in answer to your question, sort of, David, about Katie Wilson and what she'll do, I mean, yeah, I do think that she probably would have asked the police department to actually find cuts this year, or if not cuts, to sort of, because obviously we're very far away from going in the direction of any kind of cuts to the police department budget. I think she would have probably asked them to find money for these new officers, which she said she supports, in the existing budget, which is, you know, again, the biggest budget by far of any general fund department in the city.
I will say this about what Katie's saying about policing. I thought, you know, I actually emailed this to David yesterday, but I saw a quote from Katie in an interview she did with Chris Daniels from Como, where she was on the question of, you know, policing and public safety. She was talking about how there are these hotspots in the city, places like Little Saigon, where people don't feel safe. And the reason for it is that the mayor hasn't fixed the problem. And we need basically more and more consistent policing in those hotspot areas, which I thought was really interesting comment. You know, basically she was coming at, if you want to put in these terms, coming at Bruce from the right, saying you haven't done enough on public safety and there's not enough policing happening in these areas. At least that's the tenor of that comment. And
I mean, that's a little bit of a soundbite that I think, you know, it lies like the longer answer that she's given a bunch of times to this question, which is, you know, we need foot patrols. We need more cleaning, but we also need, you know, to actually address the problems of people who are addicted to substances that, you know, that cause them or lead them to commit, you know, acts of crime and also just kind of get in the way of businesses in that area, which is like undoubted. I mean, you go there, it is not an acceptable situation. And Harrell very much has not addressed it or solved it.
And there is some funding, right? There's $5 million in this budget we talked about last week for LEED. There is some funding for, you know, additional treatment and addiction stuff. But again, none of this goes really big on any of these problems, right? There's no like big move on homelessness. There's no big move on untreated addiction or mental illness here. There are incremental increases, you know, and some of them significant, but not, like I said, there's more in some places, but there's nothing new or different that I'm seeing.
Yeah. And is it clear that that's what voters necessarily want? I think they just want better rational governance. So it's not clear to me that they necessarily want to go big. You might want to go big, but I'm not sure that, for example, the mayor of Boston necessarily has gone big, and yet she's super popular. And it sounds like Katie Wilson is sounding a little bit like her, Michelle Wu. And I'll just also just point out that apparently you can hear from Katie Wilson on Como, but not Jimmy Kimmel.
Oh, well, interestingly, today as we're recording on Thursday, Katie Wilson is gearing up to have a press conference outside Como and saying that she won't participate in a Como debate until they restore Jimmy Kimmel and stop suppressing free speech. So more to come on that.
I also saw this interesting headline in the Seattle Times. King County Council bans rent setting software like RealPage. Speaking of good governance, this seems like good governance to me, basically preventing the kind of, what do they call it, sort of real-time pricing nowadays that we see in everything from ticket sales to apparently rents, that's kind of jacking up prices. And the council is calling it a kind of trust-busting legislation. So seems interesting to me. Sounds like, Sandeep, sounds like you had something to do with it. Or we're,
well,
I shouldn't
no,
say
I
do with
it.
You tried to stop it.
It was, you know, neither did I have something to do with its origination, nor did I try to stop it. The original version of this happened at the city about a month ago, month and a half ago. And it was actually one of the last thing Kathy Moore did on her way out the door. The District 5 council member who left proposed legislation to ban the use of RealPage, and then the county council has now followed suit and last week, you know, passed their version of the legislation. You know, I don't know. It's a software tool that's used. I think to some extent, I think this software tool is being kind of scapegoated a little bit by folks for, you know, the high cost of, you know, high rents in Seattle. I'm not sure how much difference it's going to make banning the software in terms of like rent, you know, rent levels in Seattle or King County. Other places that have banned it have not seemed to have seen some kind of appreciable difference in rents after the software got banned. Nonetheless, there's concerns about it, that it was, you know, that it was this unfair way of of landlords sort of maximizing rents. And so anyway, the city moved to ban it. I think there was broad consensus to do that, and the county council did it as well. Now, my involvement was
for unincorporated King County, basically.
Yes, yeah, the county legislation applies to unincorporated King County. That's right. So this is happening in other cities around the country, too, and other progressive places. So, we'll see how much difference it makes. But I didn't, I didn't have a problem with the legislation.
It's, Erica, it definitely jacks up ticket prices. I don't know.
And Uber.
So it's, and this is also Airbnb, and those kinds of companies are using this now as well. It's one of the reasons why hotel prices are so expensive, because this is what Seattle's own Expedia does. And so it's a real good way of, I love the idea that it's trust busting to go after this stuff. But Erica, what do you think?
Well, I mean, I think the examples you gave, I don't think that algorithmic rent fixing should be allowed, even with things like Uber and, Airbnbs and hotels either, and tickets. But the difference with rent is it's, the cost of somebody's home, something you have to have in order to be like a stable member of society in a city. And so, this is the idea that landlords have been able to collude to determine rent prices based on what the market, quote unquote, is able to bear. I think that is an appropriate area of government intervention, whether or not it is something that is happening a lot right now in unincorporated King County or even Seattle. It is preventative. And, even if these pieces of legislation have not driven down rents dramatically in other cities, it's very hard to prove a negative. And when you pass preventative legislation, you prevent it from getting worse, perhaps. But the evidence is not going to be in dropping rents. It's going to be in rents not rising as fast as they would have if it was sort of this market-based game, even more than it already is, with landlords being able to command prices that outpace things like inflation, things like property taxes, and things like their own cost of running an apartment building, for example.
Well, yeah. I mean, look, first of all, I think there's a legal question here about whether this does amount to like landlords colluding together in some antitrust way, or whether it's just a software tool that aggregates data that landlords can use. I think that's being legally tested right now. I think RealPage is suing folks. I have no idea what's going to happen legally in those cases, but we'll see what the courts say about the use of this kind of software. I just think, look, I mean, there are things that are the big drivers of high housing costs in Seattle and high rents in Seattle, and stuff like this, or the claims that we've heard in the past that like short-term rentals, and the rise of short-term rentals is somehow massively like driving up rents and taking lots and lots of housing stock off the long-term rental market. None of that stuff is really true. Like New York City basically banned short-term rentals last year. There's been no depreciable change in rents, right? Like, and I'm similarly, I just don't think this is the answer to the problem, or even going to make much of any difference. But whereas we're ignoring the other factors that are, which are things like, as we've talked about many times, how do we build more housing? What do we do around zoning? What do we do around, onerous, excessive regulation and bureaucracy that is driving up the cost of building and stuff like that, right? Like those are the central
issues. Yeah, I totally agree. I will say though, in this case, again, I mean, one of the people on the council with whom you are allied, Sandeep, Sarah Nelson proposed legislation that would sort of correct one of the problems that exists between landlords and tenants, which is providing some transparency into what landlords are actually charging people for rent. And, with a company like RealPage and landlords colluding illegally or not to, fix rent prices, that is a situation where landlords, once again, have all the information and even more information that's accessible, through a software that uses algorithms to determine appropriate rents. And the people have no information. The city government, county government, has no information because landlords are not required to provide that information. And Councilmember Sarah Nelson and Alex Peterson proposed legislation that was not successful that would have required landlords to provide some of that information to the University of Washington or another outside group so that there could be some transparency, but that hasn't happened. So there's just an imbalance of information, and this worsens it on the in the landlord's favor.
Erica, sticking with your earlier point, the only reason I brought up ticket prices was to say, well, we know it's jacking up ticket prices. So my guess is that it's going to be effective at doing something similar here, and it's jacking up hotel prices. So we could assume that if landlords use it correctly, it's going to jack up rents, even if we're not seeing it in the data. I mean, it's working elsewhere. And I'd also say, Sandeep, you're right about short-term rentals and the fact that maybe this isn't the big picture here, but just on the short-term rentals point, I mean, it really depends on what percentage of your overall rental supply is made up by short-term rentals or not. And in some places where it's a significant part of your rental supply, it could make a big difference. And I'll only also bring up the fact that it's inflating Airbnb and VRBO prices could draw more big and sort of mom and pop landlords into that short-term rental market away from the longer-term rental market. And in that sense, you know, further inflate, be another way in which you've got this double whammy. It's happening in the Airbnb, VRBO, Expedia market, and now in the rental market, all basically driving up prices, none of which is good for both low-income folks, but just consumers generally. So insofar as it might be an antitrust thing, it's in the interest of consumers. It's not in the interest of these big landlords and companies that are sort of jacking up rents and other prices.
Well, I should disclose here that I consult for Airbnb, right? So, you know, and I've been a longtime consultant for them. In fact, helped negotiate Seattle's short-term rental law regulatory structure back in 2015 to 2017 era. Well, first of all, look, less than 1% of units in Seattle are short-term rentals. It's a tiny fractional part of the market. Maybe there are vacation places where it's more significant, but in big blue cities like Seattle or New York City, it's not a significant part of the housing stock in ways that banning it would somehow change that stuff. And again, New York City just did it. They're studying it, makes no appreciable difference, right? It's sort of, and what it does is, and meanwhile, hotel rates in those cities have now gone up because people don't have they've reduced competition and people don't have cheaper options of doing Airbnb. So anyway.
And Expedia is using these algorithms to jack up prices for hotels, but well, yeah.
Their price fixing will never work to the advantage of the people paying the price. I mean, that's it. Just an observation. I mean, it obviously this is meant to jack up rents. There would be no other purpose for the software to exist if it were not to allow landlords to extract more money out of renters who have to have a place to live.
And again, and just to be very clear here, yeah, I mean, I don't have a problem if they want to ban the use of RealPage, but you know, whatever, go ahead and do it. And I just don't think it's going to make much difference.
Yes. Well, I guess we'll never know.
Presumably, somebody will study this somewhere, and maybe.
Last question: Pete Buttigieg endorsing Mayor Bruce Harrell. Katie Wilson's had tons of endorsements, including now that dual endorsement from the King County Labor Council, which is super interesting. But why is Pete Buttigieg endorsing Mayor Bruce Harrell?
I don't know. I thought that
why bother?
The timing of it was interesting, and by interesting I mean kind of odd, right? You know, it's possible that they have a little bit more of a personal relationship. They work together. Like Buttigieg was, you know, head of the transportation, right, under Biden, and probably, you know, dealt with the mayor and folks. So maybe there's some personal connection there. I really don't know what prompted him to kind of weigh in at the time that he did and endorse him.
And I don't know who it gets Bruce Harrell in terms of the Seattle electorate. I mean, moderate centrist endorses moderate centrist. There's the Venn diagram is kind of a circle in terms of, you know, who supports these two individuals. I mean, I know P.V. Buttigieg is very popular and he's, a great sort of debater and spokesman for the Democratic Party in a lot of ways. But I don't think anybody in Seattle is going to be looking at Bruce Harrell's list of endorsements and going, oh, right. Buttigieg. Okay, yeah. Well, never mind.
Right. There you go. I'm going to switch my vote. Right. I totally agree with that. I mean, look, I think didn't Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders endorse Lorena Gonzalez? And like for you, I mean, fat lot of good it did her, right? You know, if I'm remembering that right. So yeah, you know, outside endorsements by national figures is probably not likely to have very much impact.
I hope we see more. I like them. They're just, all right. That's it for another edition of Seattle Nice. She's Erica C. Barnett. He's Sandeep Kaushik. I'm David Hyde. Our editor is Quinn Waller. And thanks, everybody, so much for listening.